2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Section 374. The Use and Abuse of Chiasmus in Book of Mormon Studies. Participants Dan Foley and Woody Huntley.
This is a presentation by Dan Vogel titled The Use and Abuse of Chiasmus in Book of Mormon Studies. Dan is an accomplished scholar and historian of Mormonism and a dear friend of at least, two decades now. And Dan is editor of Early Mormon Documents, which is a critically acclaimed multi-volume set. For those of you who have not seen it, I encourage you to go and take a look at the set. They've got various volumes available for sale on the different tables. Dan is somebody who has had a great influence and impact on my own life and in my own quest for understanding Mormonism. One of the first projects that Dan worked on was a book on Indian origins in the Book of Mormon. And I remember reading the manuscript of that when it was basically in its infancy back in the early 1980s. And I remember thinking then that this is someone who is onto something and perhaps even far ahead of his time in coming up with the types of observations that he was making. Today, Dan has accomplished a great deal in Mormon studies. As I said, several of his many books are available out on the tables. The respondent today will be given by Woody. And Woody, if I could have you pronounce your last name. Huntemer? Huntemer, okay. Well, basically as it's spelled. Pretty straightforward. Thank you, Woody. Woody will be the respondent today. Currently, he is working on a book, Mapping Lehi's Promised Land, New Findings with Parallelistic Analysis. And he will be giving the response immediately following Dan's presentation. Dan?
Okay. Can everybody hear me? A little louder? Okay. These things aren't working too good today. I appreciate everybody coming out to such a kind of obscure subject. It's not one that I would expect a lot of people to appear at, but it's not an exciting topic, but I believe it's a necessary one to deal with because so many people have got excited about this for about 30 years now, and no one's ever given a serious response or a serious critique. In fact, it hasn't even been presented in a sophisticated manner to the Mormon audience yet. So I hope I can do that, or I can stimulate the people down at Farms to maybe do a better job at it. But how many know what chiasmus is? Oh, good. So my job's going to be easy. A little easier, There's, it's very complicated, and I might be going through it kind of fast because there's a lot to cover. A lot of the proponents of chiasmus have it pretty easy. They just show you a chiasm and wow, and then move on. But we're going to slow it down a little bit and look at it in more detail. I have a brief introductory statement to read, then we'll take a closer look at the different types of chiasmus and examine its theoretical basis. In the fall of 1969, after learning about the study of chiasmus in the New and Old Testaments, John Welsh, then a Brigham Young University graduate student, announced the discovery of what he thought were several chiastic structures in the Book of Mormon. Since that time, Welsh's discovery has generated much discussion and speculation within the Mormon community. Today, researchers have identified anywhere from 300 to 961 chiasms in the Book of Mormon. While apologists continue to exploit chiasmus as evidence for Book of Mormon antiquity, very little has been said about chiasmus itself. Many in the modern community simply assume chiasmus is a fact, and that one need only find it in the Book of Mormon. Indeed, many are unaware that there are fundamental problems with the whole theory of chiasmus, that there is scholarly tension between those who study simple forms and those who propose longer, more complex structures, and that the relationship between the former and the latter is neither clear nor universally recognized. One purpose of this essay will be to present the various reasons why some scholars, biblical scholars, have remained less enthusiastic about chiasmus. Moreover, my intention is not to deny the existence of chiasmus in all cases, but to introduce in a more balanced and critical approach to Mormon claims to foster skepticism, which I find lacking in Mormon discussions. So, let's look at our first example here. Chiasmus is a literary style which develops a series of themes, then immediately reverses the pattern in the exact order, thus ending with the first theme expressed. There are many examples of chiasmus in the Old Testament, but consider Jeremiah 2:19. Up here. You will be punished by your wickedness. Your defections will convict you. Or Jeremiah 4:22. They are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. The name chiasmus was adopted because of the reversal of binary elements suggesting the letter X, or chi in Greek, which is formed by drawing lines connecting A to A prime and B to B prime, like this. Excuse me. Continuing with our example from Jeremiah 4:22, those who study chiasmus, or chiasmists, as I call them, usually prefer to map out the elements like so. It looks much more impressive that way. It breaks it up and it kind of removes it from the original form of parallelism that it usually appears like in the Old Testament. So it takes it into a whole other realm away from what it was originally intended. These examples from Jeremiah are what is termed simple chiasmus. Simple chiasmus most often consists of two lines or a couplet, which Bible scholars refer to as a bicolon or distich. Each line may consist of two, three, or more elements. There is also a form of simple chiasmus called compound chiasmus. In brief, compound chiasmus is any jumbling of the elements or components in the second line. For example, the first line, the elements might be A, B, C, and the second line be C, A, B, or A, C, B, or B, A, C. Note the jumbling of elements in the following two examples. I will punish him for his conduct and for his deeds. I will repay him in Hosea 4:9, or Psalms 113:7. Lifting from the dust the feeble, from the midden raising the poor. Moving beyond the chiastic couplet, complex chiasms involve the thematic relationship between lines or sections rather than word order. This can involve anywhere from 4, 5, 6, 7, possibly 8 lines to whole chapters or even entire books. Some are short and tightly constructed, while others are long and diffused. In the following two examples, note how the chiasms, each consisting of 4 lines or tetracolons, are formed by the repetition of key words. Jeremiah 2:13, the fountain of living water to hew themselves cisterns, cisterns that cannot crack and cannot hold water. Or Jeremiah 9:4, each against his friend be on guard, and in every brother put no trust, for every brother only supplants, and each friend peddles slander. These are sometimes called strophic chiasms, have become a jumping stone to large-scale chiasms, which tend to be more loosely constructed and remotely paralleled. The highly conceptualized example from Isaiah chapter 1 as published by Wilfred Watson in Welsh's 1981 book Chiasmus in Antiquity. We don't have time to read this whole chiasm, but note that the center is unparalleled, but there's only one element, H. Note also that there's some sections have key words that I've put in bold, but other sections are just conceptual similarities between each of those. And some chiasmists believe that the ancients organized large sections of scripture, even entire Old Testament books, chiastically. An example of this is Yehuda T. Rowdy's compound chiastic outline of the Book of Esther, also published in Chiasmus in Antiquity. The danger in such chiastic outlines is the use of creative titling. Note also that the center is unparalleled and that C prime at the bottom is out of place, which seems to be a characteristic of most chiastic outlines from the Old Testament. Simple chiasmus is merely an inverted parallelism. There are literally thousands in the Old Testament, but for the sake of illustration, let's make one of our own by undoing the inversion or chiasm in Jeremiah 4:22. So we're just going to play with this to see how easy it is to do either one. The original chiasm that I've read, they are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. So we'll take that chiasm and we'll just straighten it out and make a regular parallelism. They are wise to do evil, but they have no knowledge to do good. Then we'll make it look very fancy by doing that. Parallelism generally consists of two lines. This was a fundamental unit of Hebrew poetry. The Book of Psalms, the Book of Proverbs, are one parallelism right after another. So that's why there's thousands or impossible situations for chiasms to occur. Or simple chiasms we're talking about right now. Parallelism has been described as a rhyme of thought rather than of sound. Since Bishop Robert Loth's time, 1753, three basic types of parallelism have been recognized by scholars: synonymous, antithetic, and synthetic. Let's take a closer look at these three types of parallelism, then we'll see how they relate to simple chiasmus. Note the use of synonyms, or mere synonyms, in the following examples of synonymous parallelism. I will divide them in Jacob, and I will scatter them in Israel, Genesis 49:7. An example of antithetic parallelism, the second line is antithetical to the first. The light of the righteous rejoiceth, but the lamp of the wicked shall be put out, in Proverbs 13:9. An example of synthetic parallelism is Psalms 3:4. Synthetic parallelism, the second line supplants or complements the first. So, I cry aloud to the Lord, but he answers me from his holy hill, in Psalms 3:4. In his 1988 study of parallelism in the Book of Mormon, Mormon apologist Donald Perry identifies 26 examples of synonymous parallelism, 19 examples of antithetical parallelism, and 36 examples of synthetic parallelism. Note the following examples. In 1 Nephi 1:15, for the soul did rejoice, and his whole heart was filled. This is an A-B pattern. Antithetic parallelism is in 1 Nephi 17:45. Ye are swift to do iniquity, but slow to remember the Lord your God. Synthetic parallelism, example of that is in 2 Nephi 2:25. Adam fell that they might be a man, that they might have John. Despite the claims of some among apologists, parallelism is not exclusively Hebraic. Parallelism might be universally recognized as the characteristic feature of biblical Hebrew poetry, to be sure, but it nevertheless appears elsewhere in less concentrated form. Indeed, parallel sentence structure is also desirable to English writers. Excuse me. In fact, preference for parallel construction is likely the reason for the King James translators not always following Hebrew word order, not because chiasmus is difficult to render into English, as some chiasmists assert. And that's one reason why I'm playing around with them, to show them that it's not really that hard as they try to make it sound. Someone imitating Bible language would have naturally fallen into parallelism, so one should not be surprised to find it in the Book of Mormon. In fact, after recommending Bishop Lent's book and describing parallelism in Hebrew poetry, Hugh Blair, in an abridgment of lectures on rhetoric, New York, 1819, then gave this advice to contemporary authors. And all writers who attempt the sublime might profit much by imitating, in this respect, the style of the Old Testament. Like parallelism, chiasmus has various forms, including synonymous, antithetical, and synthetic. To illustrate how close direct parallelism is associated with simple chiasmus, let's make one of our own from the parallelism in Genesis 49:7. So the original parallelism was, I will divide them in Jacob, and I will scatter them in Israel. So we make our own chiasm out of that, which will read, I will divide them in Jacob, and in Israel I will scatter them. Now let's take a closer look at the two major forms of simple chiasmus. The example from Jeremiah 2:19 and the one from 4:22 given previously are synonymous chiasms. Here's another, Psalms 51:7. Thoroughly wash me from my iniquity, and from my sin cleanse me. Or an antithetic chiasmus from Psalms 145:20. The Lord preserveth all them that love him, but all the wicked will be destroyed. Of the 49 non-biblical simple chiasms apologists have deduced from the Book of Mormon, there are very few, possibly only 3 so far that we've found, that might even come close to being classed as synonymous, antithetical, or synthetic. My discussion of Book of Mormon chiasms is based on an examination of 366 chiasms, with one broken down is 49 simple chiasms, 301 complex chiasms, and 16 chapter and book-length chiasms, most of which were proposed by Farm's founder John Welsh in 1969 and 1970, and Mormon apologist Donald Perry in 1988 and 1992. And these are the three. 2 Nephi 3:1. Thou wast born in the wilderness of mine afflictions, yea, in the days of my greatest sorrow did thy mother bear thee. And 1 Nephi 17:38. And he leadeth away the righteous unto precious lands, and the wicked he destroyeth. And the other one happens to be a synthetic chiasm from Alma 9:12. Yea, he will visit you in his anger, and his fierce anger he will not turn away. With only 3 examples of Hebrew-type simple chiasms, or chiasmus, in the Book of Mormon, it is difficult to prove intentionality. Now let's take a look at the remaining 46 simple chiasms in the Book of Mormon. Besides synonymous, antithetic, and synthetic chiasmus, there is a special kind of chiasmus that repeats exactly the same words used in the first colon, but in reverse order, which Wilfred Watson calls pure or near chiasmus. Other people call it literary chiasmus. There are relatively very few examples of near chiasmus in the Old Testament. Some examples are Isaiah 22:22, he shall open and no one will shut, and he shall shut and no one will open. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and children to the fathers, Malachi 4:6. Isaiah 55:8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither your ways my ways. Isaiah 5:20, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, and put darkness before light, light before darkness, and put bitter before sweet, and sweet for bitter. There are also examples of this type of chiasm in the New Testament. The children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children, 2 Corinthians 12:14. And in Matthew 10:39, he that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life shall, for my sake, shall find it. These mirror chiasms are actually examples of a much-used rhetorical device known to poets and rhetoricians as anti-metaboly, which in Greek means to turn about in the opposite direction. Anti-metaboly, like Watson's mirror chiasmus, is also a repetition of identical words or identical ideas in successive clauses in a reverse grammatical order. Anti-metaboly might appear in poetry, such as William Shakespeare's Remember March, the Ides of March, Remember, Fair is Foul, and Foul is Fair. But in the hands of rhetoricians, it can take on the added characteristic of intensifying a concept or showing contrast, as the following examples demonstrate. Life imitates art far more than art imitates life. When the going is tough, tough gets going. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. You like Coke, and Coke likes you. One more from Mormon leader Lorenzo Snow, who in 1894 said, as man now is, God once was. As God now is, man may be. Anti-metaboly has been misunderstood and misrepresented by Mormon apologists. Hugh W. Pinnock, for instance, incorrectly calls anti-metaboly antithetical chiasmus. Most of the 44 examples of anti-metaboly offered by Donald W. Perry are, in fact, antithetical parallelisms. Perry knows that the definition of anti-metaboly is to throw against in a reverse way, yet his examples neither use exact wording nor reverse the elements. So excuse my misspelling of Pinnock's name in this example, but this is what chiasmus is not. Anti-metaboly is not antithetical chiasmus or antithetical parallelism, because antithetical chiasmus is not a reversal of exact words or ideas. An example we've already seen from Psalms 145:20, this is what an antithetical chiasmus looks like. The Lord preserveth all them that love him, but all the wicked he will destroy. Doesn't use exact words, so it's not an anti-metaboly. Antithetical parallelism also is not a reversal of exact words or ideas. We've already seen Proverbs 13:9. This is an example of what an antithetical parallelism looks like. The light of the righteous rejoices, but the lamp of the wicked shall be put out. This is not exact words, and it does not reverse the order of the elements. The obfuscation of anti-metaboly likely results from the need to see in the Book of Mormon as much chiasmus as possible, and a resistance to removing some cherished examples of Book of Mormon chiasmus from evidence. The following are examples of anti-metaboly that Mormon apologists have presented as evidence for Book of Mormon antiquity. Alma 40:23, the soul shall be restored to the body and the body to the soul. 2 Nephi 29:13, and the Jews shall have the words of the Nephites, and the Nephites shall have the words of the Jews, and the Nephites and the Jews shall have the words of the last tribes of Israel, and the last tribes of Israel shall have the words of the Nephites and the Jews. And Jacob 3:7, behold, the husbands shall their wives, and their wives shall their husbands, and the husbands and the wives of your children. Romans 7:9, this is written that for the intent that you may believe that, and if you believe that, you will believe this also. 1 Nephi 1:34, and he did smite upon the people of Jesus, but the people of Jesus did not smite again. 2 Nephi 6:14-15, and none will he destroy that believe in him, and they that believe not in him shall be destroyed. Of the 49 non-biblical chiasms put forth by known apologists, 11 are anti-metabolists that exhibit both exact or near exact words or, and contrast. Anti-metabolism does not always include contrast or heightened meaning. The salient characteristic is the use of exact or near exact words rather than synonyms, antonyms, complementaries, superordinates, or reciprocals. I therefore include in this category simple reiteration, or rather reversed reiteration, as opposed to reversed parallelism. While reversed reiteration is typical of many proposed Book of Mormon chiasms, it is uncharacteristic of Hebrew literature. Note the following examples from Amos 10:9. An angel said unto me, he is a holy man, therefore I know he is a holy man because it was said by an angel of God. Romans 18:6, for he had slain many of them because their brethren had scattered their flocks at the place of water, and thus because they had their flocks scattered, they were slain. Ether 1:35, therefore he did not confound the language of Jared, and Jared and his brother were not confounded. Of the 49 non-biblical chiasms put forth by Mormon apologists, 18, or 37%, are reverse reiterations. 6 others are loosely constructed anti-metabole. Thus, anti-metabolic formulations account for 35 or 71% of the 49 possible simple chiasms from the Book of Mormon. Because anti-metabole also appears in the Bible, it is possible that Joseph Smith was influenced by these formulations as he mimicked biblical language. Ether 13:12 might be seen as evidence for this conjecture. And when these things come, bringeth to pass the scripture, which saith, there are they who were first who shall be last, and there are they who were last who shall be first. Although supposedly written thousands of years before the birth of Jesus, this Book of Mormon passage is obviously influenced by Matthew 19:30. But many that are first shall be last, or last shall be first. Another evidence that Joseph Smith understood and used anti-metabole comes from his own revelations. Note especially Joseph Smith's interpretive expansion of the anti-metabole in Matthew 19:30. The first shall be last, the last shall be first, first spiritual, secondly temporal, which is the beginning of my work, and again, first temporal and secondly spiritual, which is the last of my work. A similar interpretive expansion of Matthew 19:30 occurs in 1 Nephi 13:42. And after he has manifested himself unto the Jews, and also unto the Gentiles, then he shall manifest himself unto the Gentiles, and also unto the Jews, and the last shall be first, and the first shall be last. Clearly, the anti-metabole in the first part of the verse is directly influenced by the one borrowed from the New Testament in the second part. Obviously, Joseph Smith understood anti-metabole and could create his own. In another instance, Joseph Smith borrows a parallelism from Isaiah 44. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. Taking the first part of this passage, Smith creates the following anti-metabole in Helaman 14:23. And there shall be many mountains laid low, like unto a valley, and there shall be many places which are now called valleys, which shall become mountains, whose height is great. Which is a wordy way of saying mountains shall become valleys and valleys shall become mountains. Despite Smith's apparent attempt to disguise his source,
The phrase laid low is an unmistakable link to Isaiah 44. Nevertheless, Joseph Smith repeatedly draws on Isaiah 44 in his revelations, but in less garbled fashion. In Doctrine and Covenants 49:23, for the valleys to be exalted and for the mountains to be laid low, or DNC 109:74, and cause the mountains to flow down at thy presence and the valleys to be exalted. In another revelation, Smith rearranges the elements of Isaiah 44 in chiastic order, in DNC 133:22, which shall break down the mountains and the valleys shall not be found. This demonstrates that Joseph Smith could take a direct parallelism from the Bible and create his own chiasm by reversing the elements. Smith also had the ability to create his own chiasms from parts of verses taken from the Bible. This situation happens when Smith creates another antinatality from the second part of Isaiah 44. However, in this instance, Smith borrows the slightly different wording in Luke 3:5. And the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough ways shall be made smooth. Taking the first line from Luke 3:5, Smith creates the following antinatality in 1 Luke 5:17-46. He can cause the rough places to be made smooth, and the smooth places to be broken up. In another literary situation that induces a chiasm is Mormon 7:11. In the first part of the verse, Smith conflates James 3:11 and Matthew 7:18, taking inspiration from James's rhetorical question, "Doth a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter?" He reshapes the imagery around the antinatalic construction in Jesus' words, "A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit." In constructing his own antimetabole, Smith reversed these lines, beginning with the negative source, bitter fountain, corrupt tree, rather than the positive source, good fountain, good tree. When one compensates for this reversal, the source for Smith's antimetabole is unmistakable. In Moroni 7:11 reads, "A bitter fountain cannot bring forth good water, neither can a good fountain bring forth bitter water." Now, note how Smith imitates or parallels this word order when creating his own antimetabole in the second part of the same verse. "Wherefore, a man being a servant of the devil cannot follow Christ, and if he follow Christ, he cannot be a servant of the devil." This situation demonstrates that Smith was consciously aware of antimetabolic formulations in the Bible and used them to create his own. In addition to clear examples of Bible in the Bible of antimetabole was well known through books on rhetoric. Samuel Knox, in A Compendious System of Rhetoric, Baltimore, 1809, for instance, gives the following rhyming definition of epanagos, which is another name for chiasmus. "By epanagos, a sentence shifts its place, takes first and last, and also middle space." He then gives the following antimetabolic example: "Whether the worst, the child accursed, or else the cruel mother, the mother worst, the child accursed, as bad the one as the other." On page 112, Knox defines antimetabole as follows. Antimetabole puts changed words again by contraries, as the example will explain. "A poem is a speaking picture. A picture is a new poem." To Knox, epanagos was what might be called complex antimetabole rather than a Hebraic inverted parallelism or synonymous parallelism. Similarly, John Newton, in An Introduction to the Art of Rhetoric, London, 1671, also defines epanagos as, "An epanagos is when the like sound is in the beginning and ending of diverse sentences." But the example he gives from Isaiah 5:20 that we read before is also not an inverted parallelism,
but rather an anti-metabolism. Justice Smith's word was replete with examples of anti-metabolism in both simple and complex forms. And Samuel Knox, this guy was just previously quoting, 1809, says, when the whole is put for a part for the whole, when a genus is put for a species or a species for a genus, the singular for the plural or the plural for the singular, the figure is called syndoche. Note the following reverse reiteration. When and the same covenant, which was made to Abraham in the Old Testament, is for substance the same with that of the new, and this under the New Testament, the very same with that of Abraham's under the old. Thomas Shepherd, 18th century. Cyril Mack, about 1810, says, Jesus is mine, and I am his. According to Professor Mitchell Dayhood, complete chiasms consisting of three or more elements is a rather infrequent sequence in Old Testament literature. To make the quest for chiasms more fruitful, chiasmists have invented what they call the compound chiasm. Obviously, with binary parallelism, with only two elements, the poet's options are limited, for the second line can only either repeat the elements of the first in exact order, or reverse them. But in situations where multiple elements exist in the first line of the parallelism, the second line may not always replicate the first line exactly, or even chiastically, but can shuffle the elements. Wilfred Watson divides these compound situations into split-member chiasmus, and where the one element remains stationary, partial chiasmus. Welch offers Proverbs 2:2 as an example of compound chiasmus. Watson calls this a partial chiasmus. So that thou incline unto wisdom thine ear, and apply thine heart to understanding. A clever chiasmus might map out Proverbs 2:2 like so, like this. As with simple chiasmus, compound chiasmus in the Book of Mormon is also anti-metabolic. Mormon apologists have located only two examples of simple or simple compound chiasms, which are nearly identical to one another. Welch offered both chiasms in his 1970 thesis. 1 Nephi 13:42, and he, Jesus, had manifested himself unto the Jews and also unto the Gentiles, and then he shall manifest himself unto the Gentiles and also unto the Jews. So I think you get the idea, so I won't read the second one. By calling this compound chiasmus, Welch and other chiasmus betray their bias. For it can just as easily be called a compound parallelism. This bias has led chiasmus to view any variation from direct parallelism as chiastic. The following chart shows the possible combinations one might encounter with parallel couplets or bicolons consisting of either two or three elements. So there's eight possibilities. So the chance to run into a parallelism is 2 in 8, and the chance to run into a chiasm is 6 in 8. Thus, as Welch and other chiasmists view it, the Hebrew poet could not avoid making either a direct parallel, simple chiasm, or compound chiasm. So according to the chiasmists, what is not a direct parallel is automatically some kind of chiasm. As can be imagined, with such a liberal definition of chiasmus, one can easily find examples in a literature heavily dependent on parallelism, namely the Old Testament, or anything attempting to imitate it, I might add. The existence of numerous compound chiasms in the Old Testament naturally brings up the following question. If chiasmus was all the rage in the ancient world, as Welch and other chiasmists maintain, why would the Hebrew writers create more compound chiasms than true chiasms? More importantly, why do true chiasms appear infrequently and randomly? If the ancients had a preoccupation with chiasmus,
should we not expect to find them in clusters? Should such a situation hint at a conclusion begging for attention, but resisted if not ignored by the chiasmus, that is, that in making parallelisms, the ancients were less concerned about word order than about content. To illustrate this point further, let's examine Welsh's compound chiasm in Proverbs 2:2 in its literary context. Proverbs 2:2 is an independent poem consisting of 22 couplets. This is a literal translation showing the schema of each line to the right. Now, I know this is too small a read from the back row, but I think you get the idea. We'll look at this a little closer. If the order of the elements is random, as I suspect they are, one can reasonably expect to find 4 to 5 complete chiasms, about the same number of direct parallelisms, and about 12 compound chiasms. Note the ordering of the elements in each of these verses. So here I have the 22 verses, the order of the elements, and what kind of situation occurs, parallel or chiasmus or compound. So what we do indeed find are 4 complete chiasms, 8 compound chiasms, and 10 direct parallelisms. Viewed within the larger context of this example, chiasms appear to be random. At least one would be hard-pressed to prove otherwise. The chiasmus would have a strong case for conscious construction if they could locate a series of parallel couplets in perfect chiastic order. But this never occurs. Instead, chiasms appear randomly, and I might add, at a frequency expected for unintentional construction. Thus, it might be argued that the ancient authors were not conscious of chiasmus as a literary form, nor did they demand of themselves a slavish adherence to direct parallel structures. Apparently, in constructing parallel distichs or bicolons, the Hebrews were more concerned with meaning of words rather than with word order. It's us that's concerned with word order. It is telling indeed that in giving examples of simple chiasmus in Ugaritic literature, which consists of no more than 3 elements, Welsh gives only compound forms. Robert F. Smith admits that Akkadian chiasms are more often unbalanced and or incomplete. In his treatment of chiasmus in the Old Testament, Wilfred Watson lists 47 complete chiasms and 104 compound chiasms as a ratio of a little more than 2 to 1. This discussion on compound chiasmus leads to several unsettling conclusions. Excluding anti-metabolism, there is no evidence that simple chiasms appear in the Old Testament intentionally. There is no evidence to link chiasmus with anti-metabolism. Indeed, there is no justification for the assumption that anti-metabolic formulations either grew out of the inverse Hebrew parallelism or that anti-metabolic influenced the creation of chiasmus. Statements that the ancients were preoccupied with chiasmus are unfounded. Evidence favors random, unintentional construction for simple chiasmus in the Old Testament. Therefore, besides anti-metabolic, one should not expect to find consciously constructed simple chiasms in the Book of Mormon. This is a better explanation than Welsh's unverifiable ad hoc theory that they were lost through translation. The 3 Hebrew-like simple chiasms in the Book of Mormon probably resulted from the unintentional jumbling of elements. Mormon apologists should be troubled to find in the Book of Mormon only 3 chiasms that can be described as either synonymous, antithetic, or synthetic. Indeed, one major difference between Book of Mormon simple chiasmus and Old Testament simple chiasmus is that Hebraic chiasmus rarely uses identical words.
To
typical of examples constructed by apologists from the Book of Mormon. This reliance on exact or near exact wording, unlike the Old Testament chiasmus, indicates, at least to me, one, the Book of Mormon was composed in English and does not reflect the translation of an ancient Hebrew-based text, and two, Joseph Smith used simple reiteration when imitating Hebrew parallelism. Welch himself acknowledges the lack of evidence for authorial intent for a simple chiasmus and prefers to make his case with longer, more complex varieties. However, because the evidence favors random, accidental construction for simple chiasmus, there simply is no theoretical basis supporting the hunt for longer, more complex chiasms, which ultimately are completely different in character than the simple chiasms. While the presence of chiasmus is easily demonstrated in simple constructions, it is difficult to prove authorial intent with complex chiasmus. The reverse is seen as the case, since complex structures, the chiasmus argue, are difficult to dismiss as unintentional. The problem, however, lies in objectivity, demonstrating the existence of complex chiasmus. What the chiasmus themselves know but do not emphasize is that these extended forms of chiasmus push at the envelope of subjectivity. One indication that some complex chiasms are the result of the chiasmus ingenuity is the multiple versions of the same chiasm are possible, and that a proposed chiasm can go through revision and refinement. Welch is one of the most sophisticated chiasmists among the Mormons, yet he has offered differing versions of the same chiasm, either to expand it or to resolve perceived difficulties. He has given three versions of Alma 36 and two versions of the first book of Nephi, as well as multiple versions of two others. Donald Perry has offered differing versions of six chiasms. To demonstrate the subjectivity of creating complex chiasms, Old Testament scholar Mike Butterworth conducted an experiment in which he randomly selected verses from the book of Isaiah and created a fictitious chapter, which he dubbed Isaiah 67. Employing the standards of the chiasmists, Butterworth created a very convincing complex chiasm. To illustrate how subjectivity and manipulation can enter into making a chiasm, I will undo one proposed complex chiasm for the Book of Mormon and put it back together step by step. As an example of making one's own chiasm, let's take 1 Nephi chapter 1, proposed by Mormon apologist Donald Perry in 1992, and map it out by following its most natural demarcation or divisions. As I read, pay particular attention to how the different parts are interpreted or interrelated. Note that I have left Perry's keywords underlined. And when the Jews heard these things, they were angry with him, yea, even as with the prophets of old, whom they had cast out and stoned and slain. And they also sought his life, that they might take it away. But behold, I, Nephi, will show unto you that the tender mercies of the Lord are over all those whom he hath chosen, because of their faith, to make them mighty even unto the power of deliverance. For behold, it came to pass that the Lord spake many unto my father, yea, even in a dream, and said unto him, Blessed art thou, Lehi, because of the things which thou hast done, and because thou hast been faithful and declared unto this people the things which I commanded thee. Behold, they seek to take away thy life. And it came to pass that the Lord commanded my father, even in a dream, that he should take his family and depart into the wilderness. And it came to pass that he was obedient unto the word of the Lord, wherefore he did as the Lord commanded him. Note that Nephi's didactic statement about faith and deliverance in 4 and 6 are elaborated and completed in succeeding passages, especially 12 and 13. So, 4 through 6, 12 and 13. And note that in 4 he says, I will show that faith and deliverance, and that this comes together, that you should depart into the wilderness and be obedient unto the word of the Lord. Is there one way of looking for chiastic situations is to pay particular attention to summary and conclusion statements at the ends of passages, which are natural links to previous material. However, Perry chose to emphasize the verbal link between 3 and 11. Excuse me. which forced him to cut 1 and 2 and 12 and 13. So that's out. Sometimes this can be done smoothly, but often it creates an abrupt beginning, as in this example. Most chiasmists are not deterred by this, however. Nevertheless, this will give us our beginning and ending. So now, note the emerging structure through the eyes of the chiasmist. Here's A and A prime we got so far. Now that the ends have been established, the chiasmus moves inward, searching for repetition. Note, no matter how minor or insignificant. Because there is no parallel to Nephi's didactic phrase in 4, which is a major element in the passage, the chiasmus passes to the parenthetical phrase about faith in 5, and notices that faithful appears in 10. So 5 and 10 there, which by joining 5 with 4 to make B, the chiasmus not only preserves the chiasm, but conceals irrelevant and unparalleled material. So here's our other, that's going to be our other B. Oops. So now let's see what we have so far created. A with B and A prime and B prime here. Unable to make parallels between 6 and 9 and 7 and 8. 6 and 9 and 7 and 8 are not parallel. The chiasmus artificially splits 7, taking advantage of its wordiness. It is not essential that the chiasmus split the center, for there are many proposed chiasms without parallel centers. However, in this instance, the chiasmus has found a center for his structure, although it is not what I would call a false center, because it is not a symmetrical parallelism, and it is not exactly the turning point of the passage. Nevertheless, in the eyes of the chiasmist, of a determined chiasmist, the chiasm looks like this. So we got our A and B, and A and B prime, and now we have our center, which will be C. This final, the final step is to conceal irrelevant material. So the chiasmus joins 6 with B, and 8 and 9 with C prime. So these will be joined with that. Like that. So, after hiding all the irrelevant stuff, this is our final form of the chiasm by Donald Perry in 1992. Applying the criteria of a growing number of Bible scholars to complex chiasmus proposed by Welsh and others at Farm, particularly Donald Perry, one can easily see that the vast majority depart from what the chiasmus themselves call symmetrical parallelism. While Welsh and other chiasmus point to symmetry and complexity as signs of conscious design, most exhibit imbalance, questionable demarcation, mixed parallel styles, arbitrary omission and inclusion of key elements. Additionally, many proposed Book of Mormon chiasms ignore and disrupt more dominant literary patterns and serve no discernible literary purpose. When one or more of these characteristics are present, it is much easier to assign these problems to apologetic ingenuity, manipulation, and wishful thinking than to buy into the ad hoc hypothesis offered by Welsh and others that the ancient authors simply took some liberty with the form. Here are some of the criteria used by scholars to test claims of chiasmus in the Hebrew Bible. Some are similar to Welsh's criteria, while others are different. Because they tend to be a little more stricter. Because time is limited, I will review only the first seven briefly. In the category of errors of symmetry, there is lopsided design. Welsh speaks of balance. However, he is only concerned with balance on either side of the middle, rather than balance between parallel sections. In Welsh's chiasm of Alma 36, for example, section H has 212 words, while H prime has only 48. The second problem is asymmetrical design. This category includes chiasms that exhibit a literary pattern in one section that is not reflected in its parallel section. In Perry's chiasm of Mosiah 4, 11 through 12, for example, section C is arranged in an AB pattern, whereas C prime has no arrangement. Would an ancient chiasmus not want to mirror the same literary pattern in both sections? The problem three, your irregular arrangement. This refers to compound forms of complex chiasms. If you recall Yehuda T. Roddy's outline of the Book of Esther, it was a compound chiasm. If chiasmus was the ideal, why would the supposed ancient chiasmus deviate from it so frequently? Problem four, unparalleled center. Now, John Lund, in the 1930s, got this whole thing going, in our time anyway, and Welsh believed that the center need not have a couplet. These examples are serious violations of symmetry, balance, and parallelism. I include this category, in this category, chiasms with false centers. Problem five, atypical patterns, or unique patterns. As Mike Butterworth observed, techniques discovered in several different passages may be regarded as more secure than those found only once or twice. In the category of errors of subjectivity, there's questionable demarcation. Problems with demarcation might include A, abrupt transitions between sections, awkwardly long sections designed to conceal irrelevant, unchiastic, and unparalleled material, as well as potential mavericks, which are stray keywords, and C, abrupt beginning and ending, or what has been called the problem of loose ends. Problem seven, arbitrary labeling and questionable linkage. Or the parallel passages are just not simply parallel, but they still refuse to discard them. Now, Welsh is a good example. This is Welsh's example of 1 Nephi 15, 9 through 11, where he parallels perish with faith. He knows that it's not parallel, but he still refuses to discard it as an example. He even republished it in 1982. While Welsh uses some of these criteria to determine the degree to which one can say chiasmus is in a given text, Bible scholars use them to demonstrate the degree to which modern chiasmus are imposing a chiastic pattern onto the text. In other words, while Welsh might want to explain deviation as an ancient writer's prerogative, a more critical and scholarly approach would be to exclude such examples from consideration altogether. This is a little quick, I'm not going to read this, of course, but this is a quick example of lopsided design, asymmetrical design, atypical pattern, questionable demarcation. So here we'll see if you can read it. I'm not sure if you can read it, but here we have in D. D has 39 words, whereas D prime right here has only 14 words, or E up here has 11 words, and then E prime down here has 54. This is a serious mistake or a serious error to Bible scholars. The asymmetry would be in D. You can see that there's an A-B-A-B pattern used here, but in D prime there's nothing. It's not even a complete sentence. The demarcation is a little more involved, but you can tell that the long ones are concealing unparalleled material. An atypical pattern is there's a large chiasm being constructed, and within the large chiasm, right here at E, you can see there's an A, an F, there's a B, C, then it goes A, and then F, a B, and then a C. There's not very many examples. This is not a very frequent pattern offered by chiasmus, so this would be suspect. Okay, we're nearing the end. I have not completed my analysis of proposed Book of Mormon chiasm, so what follows is tentative and may undergo some slight modification. Of the 301 proposed complex chiasms, I exclude from this list chapter and book length chiasms, or those that are paraphrased, of which there are 16. 168, or more than half, or 55%, exhibit at least one element that is lopsided. 24 or 8% exhibit asymmetry. However, only 59 of the 301 proposed chiasms have opportunities for asymmetry, which means that 41% of this latter group are asymmetrical. There are only 6 compound forms, so that's not a significant problem. 69 or 23% have unparalleled centers. If we add to this number chiasms that have false centers or those that have been incorrectly divided, which there are 11, the number of chiasms with unparalleled centers increases to 26%. There are only 5 obvious examples of atypical pattern. Of the 301 proposed chiasms, 147 or 49% exhibit problems with demarcation. 77 or 26% have one or more sections that are either unparallel or very weak. One or more of these errors I've just described thus far, in fact, 255 or 85% of the 301 proposed complex chiasms. Even if one allows for the possibility that complex chiasmus might occasionally appear in the Book of Mormon, the multitude of near misses points to what statisticians call the fallacy of the enumeration of favorable circumstances, or emphasizing the successes and disregarding the failures. In other words, in a book replete with repetition and chiastic-like structures, one would not be surprised to find some relatively good examples. I conclude by showing examples of complex chiasmus among Joseph Smith's contemporaries. Charles Caleb Colton in the 18th century said, How strange it is that we of the present day are constantly praising that past age which our fathers abused, and are constantly abusing that present age which our children will praise. Charles Wesley, 1742. Hast thou received the Holy Ghost? If thou hast not, thou art not yet a Christian, for a Christian is a man that is anointed with the Holy Ghost and with power. John Wesley, 18th century, except he be born again, none can be happy, even in this world, for it is not possible in the nature of things that a man should be happy who is not holy. The top one is too complex, and of course violates as many errors as the farms chiasms do, but it is still an example, but I won't read that. I'll just read Solomon X. Come all to Jesus, my friends, come to Jesus. And finally, James Strang, who said in 1851, I'll just read the first one because it's short, you shall not clothe yourselves after the manner of the follies of men, but after the manner that is seemly and convenient shall you clothe yourselves. No matter one's definition of chiasmus, whether it's so broad that chiasmus can be found almost everywhere, including Joseph Smith's revelations, or so narrow that most proposed Book of Mormon chiasms are excluded, the apologetic value of chiasmus is highly questionable, if not altogether unconvincing. Thank you for your attention.
Go ahead and
you're not going to introduce him?
I already did. Here's Woody. Now, I'm sorry. We'll go ahead and have Woody give the response now. Since I've already introduced him at the beginning, I won't repeat it now.
This is my daughter, Brittany. She's up here to give me a little bit of moral support and to see if she can run the...
Could I just have you go ahead and...
Okay, sorry about that.
Sorry. More for the tape.
Okay. Well, when I arrived here Monday from Washington State, I had no idea I'd be here today. Hope you'll excuse me if I stumble. I haven't read this yet. So we'll both hear it for the first time together. You can turn that on. I'm not a scholar of Hebrew literary forms, nor do I claim any particular expertise in English literature. My only qualification for being here is that I have some familiarity with the parallelistic literary patterns in the Book of Mormon, and I've learned how to use them to obtain more and clearer information from the text. Parallelistic patterns, including chiasmus, were not placed in the text of the Book of Mormon to prove its antiquity, although I believe their existence is evidence that the book was not produced by someone from our culture. They were used by the original writers in a manner somewhat comparable to modern punctuation to convey information that is, and that's where my interest lies. I'd like to thank Dan for sharing his research in some of the early efforts to demonstrate chiasmus in the Book of Mormon, but I must say that in many aspects of what he says is somewhat old news. To illustrate what I mean, Monday I was talking with John Tuetnes at Farms down at BYU. Brother Tuetnes is enjoyable to talk with, but not particularly diplomatic. When I mentioned Donald Perry's 1992 work, The Book of Mormon Reformatted According to Parallelistic Patterns, he rolled his eyes and said, "Oh, that. It's superficial and clumsy, and misses much of more than it finds. Parallelism in the Book of Mormon is much more intricate and complex than Don understood back then." even though it was that book that sparked my interest in Book of Mormon parallelism, I had to agree. I seldom open it anymore because every time I do, I'm seized with the desire to rewrite. In Dr. Perry's defense, let me say that publishing an immature and fast-changing field like the study of parallelism in the Book of Mormon can be hard on the ego. A person may spend years preparing work and then spend another year or more working to get it published, and by the time it rolls off the press, the writer, if he's continued his studies, may find that the published work bears little resemblance to his present understanding of the field and he may wish to take it back and start over. The study of chiasmus in the Book of Mormon has come a long way since Welch in 69 and 70 and Perry in 1988 and 92. However, the field is not yet mature and will likely continue to change rapidly into the foreseeable future. With respect to Dan's comparison between Hebrew-type chiasmus found in the Old Testament and Book of Mormon chiasmus, I would advise caution in drawing any conclusions concerning the validity of one or the other. It's true, according to the Book of Mormon, that Lehi and his family came out from Jerusalem and that they brought the writings of Hebrew prophets with them. Nevertheless, the Nephite literary tradition was not a continuation or imitation of the tradition they left. Nephi, who essentially invented the Nephite culture, being one of a rather small group and being the leader and also a rather Renaissance-type character. Nevertheless, let me see. Okay. Nephite, who essentially invented the Nephite culture that would follow after him for nearly 1,000 years and whose writings became the standard for those who came after him, said this about the differences between the Hebrew prophetic style and his own. This is Nephi. "Behold, Isaiah spake many things which are hard for many of my people to understand, for they know not concerning the manner of prophesying among the Jews. For I, Nephi, have not taught them many things concerning the manner of the Jews. Wherefore, I write unto my people, according to the plainness which hath been with me from the time that I came out from Jerusalem with my father. For behold, my soul delighteth in plainness, and my plainness unto my people, that they may learn." This is from the first four verses in 2 Nephi chapter 25, and again in verses 5 and 6 he reiterated the same general idea. "I know that the Jews do understand the things of the prophets, and there is none other people that understand the things which were spoken unto the Jews like unto them, save it be that they were taught after the manner of the things of the Jews. But behold, I, Nephi, have not taught my children after the manner of the Jews." Now, Nephi's writing was thoroughly parallelistic, and so the writing of the culture that bears his name was also parallelistic. And while Nephite parallelism was certainly related to Hebrew-style parallelism, as Nephi explained, it was not the same. Thus, a comparison between the two would be expected to show both similarities and differences. In fact, given Nephi's explanation, the complete absence of either similarities or differences between the two literary traditions should raise eyebrows. Now, about chiasmus in the Book of Mormon, Dan Vogel has analyzed a large number of chiasms proposed by various LDS scholars and found many of them to be faulty in one way or another. On this issue, I cannot disagree with Dan. I have this same experience. It is with his response to this situation that I take issue. For example, Dan Vogel analyzed Perry's proposal. I'm not sure, did you leave the second one out? I read your paper. But, okay. Okay, Brittany. T1A there. Okay. No, that's all right. I'm just going to agree with what you said. Dan analyzed Perry's proposal for a simple chiasm in 1 Nephi 15:25 and found it lacking and therefore dismissed it. In fact, suggested, as with the other one, that Perry was trying to hide things. As Dan showed, both the A and B steps were unbalanced, and the last part of the thought is left in limbo. I agree with Dan's conclusion that Perry's analysis in 1 Nephi 15:25 is faulty. In fact, my own study suggests that Perry was often wrong in his 1992 work, but it would not occur to me to dismiss the pattern just because Perry missed the mark. Closer examination reveals that the passage is indeed parallelistic with strong chiastic elements, but the parallelism is not simple. The context of this pattern is Nephi's explanation of Lehi's dream. Nephi had just recounted this explanation to his brothers of the meaning of the rod of iron in their father's dream. He then explained how it applied to them. Brittany. Nephi's central point in the A steps, referring back to the rod of iron, was to give heed unto the word of God. The second A step augments the first by showing that giving heed means not only hearing, but doing. And note that in the typical Hebrew fashion, which Dan demonstrated in a couple of areas that he was talking about, Nephi neglects to include the final repetition of give heed, knowing that in his culture it would be understood. Finally, at the apex of the chiasm, Nephi emphasized the extreme importance of his counsel to his brothers and to us. With the simple parallelism, all the energies of my soul and all the faculty which I possessed. This passage in its new format is no longer a simple chiasm, but it is nevertheless a very impressive and informative parallelistic pattern. Something Dan said is also true. Sometimes when we put them in these nice forms like this, they look like they're carved in stone. And that's not the case, and the ancient writers didn't do it that way. It was a cultural expectation. People being raised in such a culture could see and understand that there were parallelistic elements and could see structure in that. And that was the communicated value. It was because these structures tended to act in a manner something like punctuation to us that they were of value to them. They were communicating information. Okay. In the Book of Mormon, mixed parallelisms, parallelistic patterns such as this one are more common than pure chiasmus, but the pure patterns are common enough. Consider a mundane passage in Alma 31. Therefore he took Ammon and Aaron and Omner and Himni, and he did leave, and Ahimna he did leave in the church in Zarahemla, but the former three he took with him, and also Amulek and Zizrom, who were at the Nelek, and also two of his sons. Now the eldest of his sons he took not with him, and his name was Helon, but the names of those whom he took with him were Shiblon and Corianta. Well, this listing of names comes from Mormon's narrative about Alma's mission to the Zoramites. As English prose, it sounds as if Mormon just mentioned the names off the top of his head as they came to him, but the character of the passage changes when viewed as Nephite parallelism. Structured so that we can see the pattern, this turns out to be a well-thought-out chiasm. The A steps list two sets of brothers, the sons of Mosiah and the sons of Alma. The B steps list those who were left to take care of the church in Zarahemla. The C steps recapitulate the A steps, and the D step lists Alma's old companions in the ministry who had been with him since Ammonihah and Sidon. Typically, chiasmus places the most important element at the apex, the center, and the next most important elements at the A steps, or the outside. And here, just as prescribed, the leaders are at the apex, and the rest of those that Alma took with him are in the A steps, and those in the B steps are not important to the story of the mission to the Zoramites, and the C steps merely assert that those in the A steps are in an inferior position to the apex D step. This kind of a list would not easily occur to someone in our culture, but in a culture that organized their thought and communication parallelistically, it would be expected. The last two examples, I'm sorry, I would like to go a little bit more point by point than thematically, but I don't have too much time, and the resources I had with me up here are not like I would have in Washington, so Anyway, the last two examples of Nephite parallelism are taken from my present studies about Book of Mormon geography. Another geographical chiasm explains the names of the lands called Lehi and Mulek in the Book of Mormon. That's 2-3. Now, the land south was called Lehi, and the land north was called Mulek, which was after the son of Zedekiah, for the Lord did bring Mulek into the land north and Lehi into the land south. Now, the apex of this chiasm is an interesting play on the son of Zedekiah. The Hebrew name Zedekiah can roughly be translated as the hand of the Lord, and hence the son of Zedekiah could be thought of as the one that was brought forth by the hand of the Lord. By this play on words, the E steps are parallel. By the use of the name Zedekiah in this way, Mormon seems to be citing a previous geographic passage by Malachi in the book of Omni. Brittany? Thanks. In this passage, Malachi explains that the ancestors of the people of Zarahemla, Mulek and those who came with him, came from Jerusalem shortly after Lehi and his family. And the parallel of the A steps, Mosiah discovered, is obvious. The B steps contrast leaving one promised land, Jerusalem, with entering another, Lehi's promised land. The C steps, again, play on the name of Zedekiah, and the apex steps compare the spiritual wilderness that was Babylon with the physical wilderness through which they traveled. Go ahead, Rick. The geographic link suggested by the play on Zedekiah's name between this passage and the previous one is that in Helaman 6:10, Mormon said that the Lord did bring Mulek into the land north, while Malachi in Omni 1:16 explained that Mulek, or his descendants, were brought by the hand of the Lord into the land where Mosiah discovered them. For any geography buffs in the audience, the linking of these passages shows that the land north in Helaman 6 was the land of Zarahemla and not the land northward, as most published works on the Book of Mormon geography have proposed. Mormon's citation of the Malachi by means of a more elaborate play on the name of Zedekiah is also consistent with Hebrew tradition. Both Old and New Testament writers and the Savior himself often cited the writings of earlier prophets by means of altered, partially inverted, or elaborated quotations. Jack Welch reminds us that there happens to be a law of Hebrew rhetoric called Seidel's Law that claims that when ancient writers quoted a text, they tended to invert the elements in the quotation. Since Helaman 6:10 is both elaborated and partially altered, I should say partially inverted, it seems to be a classic example of this practice. This ancient prophetic literary device may suggest an alternative to Dan's suggestion on page 13 of his presentation that Joseph Smith was disguising his source by reversing the elements. Should the prophet Joseph Smith be condemned for following this ancient literary practice? It appears that Dan's attribution of the deceitful motives in this case was ill-advised. In a really quick conclusion, let's see what time it is, by the way. Okay. I don't really have time for more. Maybe people have questions of Dan or me. I do have another transparency that shows a little bit about flexibility of the parallelism in the Book of Mormon, but I don't think I'll go into that. To summarize, then, the presence of chiasmus and other parallelistic patterns in the Book of Mormon does not prove the book's antiquity, nor does it prove a relationship between the Hebrew and Nephite literary traditions. It is, however, one of many evidences for these things. Nevertheless, these are side issues in my estimation. The real significance of parallelistic patterns in the Book of Mormon is that by analyzing these patterns, a serious student of the book can obtain more and clearer information about what the book says. And thank you very much.
Sorry. A sincere and heartfelt thanks to both Dan and Woody for their participation. Woody, again, we appreciate you stepping in. He did not have much time to put this together. I think you did an excellent job. Again, too, Dan, thank you for your presentation. We had asked Jack Welch to come and respond initially. Unfortunately, his schedule wouldn't permit that. And so we appreciate Woody stepping in on such short notice. Thank you very much. And let's go ahead and take a few questions from the audience, if we could. Yes?
I just wanted to know, I don't think you're correct on the relation of Zedekiah to hand of the Lord. I believe it's the right
physiology. It can also be interpreted as the right hand of the Lord.
How do you bring that down?
As being righteous.
What?
I think I understand what he's saying, right? The left meant sinister, right? And the right was meant good. And so I think that that's where he's drawing that from. I understand. Yeah, right. Right. So in other words, the question, just to repeat it for the purposes of the tape recorder that's listening to me right now, basically the idea is that Zedekiah, if we were to understand that in more literal terms, I suppose, we would be understanding it differently than meaning the hand of the Lord. Is that basically what you're saying? Correct. Okay.
If it was the right hand of the Lord rather than a literal meaning of the name, why would you have right hand of the Lord?
Right. Right. Well, those are the types of issues that need to be addressed. I mean, we have to take it to a more critical level and not just assume that because we can draw, you know, certain types of levels of parallels that they're just going to work, period. Anyone else, please? Yes, in the back. Yes. As long as you don't go on for a long time. No, just kidding. That was just a joke. What really disappoints me about a lot of the work on Chiasmus is that it's largely done without regard to the rest of the work on the Book of Mormon. I'll make a comment and then let you respond. The matter of fact is that based upon DNA, as we saw from the previous presentation, based upon archaeology, based upon history, based upon psychoanalytic analysis of the Book of Mormon by Bob Anderson, based upon numerous different web methods of looking at the Book of Mormon, they repeatedly show a 19th century origin. Yet, there's this one small area of Chiasmus that's going on saying, oh, we've got literary forms that, as Dan has shown, are very flexible and very, very capable of being manipulated. And it's going on largely without acknowledging the larger body of literature on the Book of Mormon. And so, I don't know, what's my question? But I think that we need to take the larger that larger context into account in looking at this. And I'll let these guys respond.
Woody said it's an old noose. Well, they're talking among themselves then, but in the literature, it's not old news. And what I want to, I don't want to deny every chiasm and try to argue over each little strand of evidence. What I'm trying to do is to make it a more critical situation so that hopefully after my paper, they could never talk about chiasm in the same way ever again. That they'll never be able to just throw up one and say, see, isn't that pretty? And impress everybody. I wanted to bring a more sophistication into the discussion. I do understand that Jack Welch is a far more conservative than Perry, for example. But unfortunately, Jack Welch hasn't chosen to come out in the public and apply his 15 criteria to Perry's chiasms. Instead, Jack Welch satisfied just to give out 15 criteria in very vague terms, giving no examples, and leaving it as that. I would love for him to come out in the public and tell us which ones he thinks are weak and why. That's not a very good position for him. That's why I don't believe he's really willing to do that, because when you start pointing out weak ones, then you start diluting the power of the influence of, or the utility of chiasm or chiasmus as an apologetic. And then what we would have is the Mormons